Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Country Music, A Very Short Introduction, by Richard Carlin. Narrated by Michael Butler Murray. Introduction. Cowboy hats, pickup trucks, tank tops, leather boots. Country music has been defined as much by its symbols as it has by its sound. It is a music of timeless themes, telling stories of love gone wrong and families torn asunder. It's peopled by hard-drinking, hard-fighting, and hard-working folks. It has both benefited from its association with the old strange America, the so-called backwoods that are inhabited by the unrefined sons and daughters of the rough-hewn immigrants who first captured the land from its original owners, and been derided for this same association. Branded as the music of hillbillies, hicks, and hayseeds, of rednecks and racists, country music is the poor stepchild of American popular musical styles. Lacking the intellectual or street cred of jazz and blues, show tunes and soul, rock and roll and rap. Yet when more accurate ways of measuring record sales came into being, it became rapidly clear that country music is the most popular of all musical styles in terms of sheer numbers. And the music has stubbornly endured, just as its best performers never seem to retire. While occasionally it surfaces to the top of America's consciousness, it is country's deep-rooted, almost subterranean nature that has made it in many ways America's most profound indigenous pop music. Inherently nostalgic, country music is accused of only looking backward in its lyrics, politics, and musical style. But this is somewhat misleading, because, as with the most dynamic popular styles, there are always forces pushing forward too, as new creative voices emerge. And, as in other musical styles, these new voices are often resisted by the old guard, who think they alone can legitimately define what constitutes real country music. This creative tension is behind the evolution of many subgenres, from the sentimental songs and old-time dance music of the 20s, through the western swing of the 30s and 40s, and the honky-tonk of the later 40s and early 50s, to country-politan from the mid-50s through the mid-60s, and country-pop in the 70s, through neo-traditional and country rock in the 80s and 90s, to bro country in the 2000s and 2010s, and so on and so on. Every style having one foot in the past and one stepping toward the future. And like all popular music styles, the creative is constantly counterbalanced by the commercial, or at least the need to achieve a level of commercial success that can sustain a musical career. The gatekeepers try hard to define and contain a musical style that is, by its very nature, ever-changing and insistent on defining itself. Although country values are often positioned against those of the city, country music's popularity is not limited to the so-called flyover states. Perhaps due to its association with rural life, country music has always fascinated city dwellers, who sentimentalize it as reflecting a simpler, easier way of American life. Nowadays, city dwellers may be embarrassed to say they love country music, although they're quick to embrace so-called new genres like Americana, alt-folk, or retro-country, all of which are just country music dressed up in more appealing clothing. The zen-like notion behind Kris Kristofferson's famous lyric, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose," is just another side of the more chest-thumping nationalistic ideals of freedom expressed in Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. Country songs have a way of sidestepping ideologies by being open to each listener's own interpretation, connecting rural and city ideals in unexpected ways. Think of country music as a river, flowing along from a starting point in the distinctly American marriage of European and African-American musical cultures, meandering through different regions, straying off the path from time to time, but always somehow regaining its footing. So this little book is not meant to define country music, but rather to dip its toes into the water from time to time, looking for commonalities and differences, expanding a bit to cover favorite styles and performers, and trying to be a trustworthy guide. You may disagree with the route that it follows or object to the selected stops along the way, so feel free to stray off the path and explore on your own. The music is wide-ranging enough to encompass many different viewpoints. Like all popular music styles, the best country music balances the personal with the commercial. It is both nostalgic and progressive, reflecting earlier influences while rejecting their limitations. And ultimately, it is expressive of our cultural values, both the laudable and the lamented. This short book tracks it all, hopefully in a way that is both enjoyable and provocative. 1. Behind the Big Bang, The Roots of Country Music. In late July of 1927, New York record producer and music publisher Ralph Peer showed up in a tiny Tennessee town on the Virginia border, carrying with him all the necessary equipment to set up a portable studio. He came to record then-best-selling country star Ernest Stoneman and his family, whom Peer had previously recorded for OK Records. Now working for Victor, Peer asked Stoneman how he could locate other acts that might have the same sales appeal as Stoneman's group. Stoneman told the producer that if he wanted to record authentic country, blues, and gospel music, he had to travel to where the music was made and not wait for groups to find their way to New York. Stoneman suggested that the producer make his base in Bristol because it was the hub of the Tri-Cities region, then the largest urban area in the South. Lacking a proper recording studio, Peer found an open space above a hat factory, which was conveniently located right on the town's main street. In anticipation of his trip, Peer had run newspaper ads announcing that he'd pay any artist $50 per accepted side, song recorded and issued, plus a small 2.5-cent royalty on any sales. Not surprisingly, the first act Peer recorded was Stoneman and his group. Few others took up the offer, until a local newspaper ran an article noting that Stoneman had made $3,600 in royalties on a single hit record. His recording of the old play party song, Skip to My Lou, released in 1926. This article caught the eye of the mother of a member of a band called the Tenava Ramblers. The group originally hailed from Bristol and had been working on the radio out of Asheville, North Carolina. She urged them to return to Bristol, where they successfully auditioned for Peer. However, before actually recording, the band had a falling out with their lead singer over how they would be credited on the record, so he ended up recording as a solo artist. That singer was Jimmy Rogers, who recorded a single 78, The Soldier's Sweetheart, backed with Sleep, Baby Sleep, thus earning the promised $100 for his work. The resulting 78 sold well enough to convince Peer to bring Rogers to Victor's main studios in Camden, New Jersey, where he cut 4 more songs, including his signature best-selling hit, Blue Yodel, also known as T for Texas, launching his career. 3 days before Rogers arrived in Bristol, another group made the journey to the town from their home base in rural Southwest Virginia. Alvin Pleasant Carter, known as AP, was a traveling fruit tree salesman who was married to Sarah Addington, a talented singer and auto harp player. Carter, Sarah, and AP's sister-in-law, Maybelle, would often sing together at home, particularly enjoying the popular sentimental songs of the day. Sarah's deep lead voice was complemented by AP's bass and Maybelle's tenor harmony. Maybelle had also developed a unique way of playing the guitar, connecting the individual chords by playing short runs on the bass strings. Peer had heard of the family and had written to them to let them know he'd be in Bristol, but he received no response. So when they showed up at his studio in late July, he was somewhat surprised to see them. His initial impression was not too positive. They wandered in, P Pierre told an interviewer in 1959. He's dressed in overalls, and the women are country women from way back there. They look like hillbillies. But as soon as I heard Sarah's voice, that was it. I knew it was going to be wonderful. On August 1st, the group recorded four songs, two of which were issued by Victor the following November. Thus began the phenomenal career of the Carter family. Many scholars have come to view Pierre's sessions in Bristol as a key date in country music history, dubbing it the Big Bang that ignited an entire industry. Like all founding myths, this somewhat simplifies the story. As early as 1922, there had been successful country recordings. But the presence in one place of these two seminal acts, representing as they did two important strands in the country style, was indeed an important event. It is possible to argue that Rogers's blues-influenced singing represented one strand of the country sound, drawing on traditional African-American music, while the Carters represented the other, the Anglo-American traditions. This, of course, is also an oversimplification, but it serves as a stepping-off point for our story. How did country music evolve? What were its antecedents? How did this unique style draw on different cultures to become a uniquely American creation? Old Familiar Tunes. Country Music and Its Roots, 18th Century to 1920. Like most American musical forms, country music developed out of many different influences. Although viewed today as the music of white Southerners, it in fact includes strong elements of African-American traditions, as we will see. Other groups, including Spanish, French, and Native American musicians, also added to the mix, as musical influences have always freely traveled from place to place. This chapter will explore those roots and how this music was initially documented and received by scholars, folklorists, and performers and songwriters themselves. It will also explore how selective aspects of these musical influences were used to market this music, particularly through new performance styles and music publishing. Anglo-American traditions, ballads, dance, and religious music. The music of the British Isles is remarkably diverse, with several types of music performed in a variety of styles and on different instruments. We will focus particularly on the sung tradition of folk balladry, music for dancing, and religious music for worship. Ballads are long narrative folk songs that often tell stories based on legend and myth. They are generally strophic, that is, they have a melodic structure that follows the lyrics and repeats as each new stanza is sung. They are usually sung by solo vocalists in a heightened style that emphasized the fact that these songs were set apart from everyday experience. This could include heavy vocal ornamentation, use of falsetto, a tight-throated nasal vocal style, and other techniques that, like those of the best opera singers, were as much a part of the expressive culture of these songs as the melodies and texts themselves. Some of the greatest ballad singers in the American traditions, such as Dillard Chandler or Almeda Riddle, would apply their vocal techniques to all types of songs, elevating even popular numbers like the sentimental country hit Old Shep into the realm of high art. The original scholars who collected ballads were primarily interested in the literary qualities of their lyrics. Some hoped to discover English language sagas that would rival the ancient Greek epics. For this reason, most of these collectors published only the lyrics of these songs and ignored the singing traditions. Some drew from printed sources rather than singers themselves. The best-known American collector was the Harvard English professor Francis James Child, whose five-volume collection of ballads, compiled over the last two decades of the 19th century, established certain songs as being true ballads. Child created a numbering system that is still in use today. More recent or topical ballads were not included in his collection, because Child felt they were somehow less legitimate than those that seemed to him to be more ancient. 19th-century authors like Sir Walter Scott and poets like Robert Burns also helped to promote the idea of ballads as being a unique product of the British, or in their case, Scottish, people. In the wake of the work of Child and other ballad scholars, early folklorists began recording their full text and music, either in notation or on early recording media, such as wax cylinders and discs. Ballads were particularly popular from the mid-18th century in Great Britain, so it's not surprising that the first settlers to come to the United States brought these songs with them. While ballads could be found throughout the original 13 colonies, the singing tradition seemed to be particularly popular in the Appalachians, where settlers were often cut off from newer forms of music and entertainment. This, at least, was the belief of early collectors, including the British team of Cecil Sharp and Maud Carpelez, who sought out remnants of the Child ballads in the southern mountains. Like many folklorists, they viewed ballad singing as a dying tradition that had to be preserved, with its singers being the last remaining practitioners of what they viewed as an ancient art. Ironically, every new generation of collectors took a similar view, so that the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of the early ballad singers were also viewed as strange musical holdouts, whose music had to be preserved before it quickly perished. By the early 19th century, ballad singing was a unique part of Southern musical identity, particularly among the mountaineers, who scraped out livings working small subsistence farms. Dance music was another important music form that was brought to the new continent from the British Isles. In the 1700s, London publisher John Playford published what many considered to be the first modern collection of English dance music, along with instructions on how to perform the dances. Traveling dance masters were common throughout the colonies, particularly in New England, teaching both the music and steps to an eager audience. Tiny portable fiddles, sometimes built into a walking stick, were often used to provide the music, although the popular military instruments of fife and drum, which the American military had introduced during the Revolutionary War years, were also used to accompany dances. Finally, religious song was brought to America by the Puritan churches. Faced with the prospect of teaching these songs to a largely musically illiterate population, traveling singing masters developed a new form of notation, using different shapes to distinguish the different scale tones. Shape note singing originally arose in New England during the late 18th century and then spread to the South and West. Itinerant teachers went from town to town, mostly at the invitation of a local church, to teach the choir how to sing. They employed special songbooks that drew on a repertoire of well-known folk tunes and hymns that were popular in early America. These hymns were often limited to a five-note, pentatonic scale, which was common to folk tunes. The harmonies were also simplified, based on common intervals, such as fourths and fifths, giving the music a distinct archaic sound. By singing the tones associated with the shapes, the congregation could quickly learn new songs and new harmonies. Although shape note singing soon died out in the cities, where more sophisticated congregations learned to read music properly, it lingered in rural areas. Annual conventions were held with the purpose of singing an entire songbook in a single day and evening. This was accomplished by rapidly reading each hymn. This helped singers remember the repertoire, and also encouraged them to broaden the number of songs they performed throughout the year. These events would also involve communal socializing, and often a large community-prepared meal would be served about halfway through the day. Much of this music might never have been known beyond the individual musicians and the local communities where they lived, but at the dawn of the 20th century, a new breed of folklorists and song collectors arose, with the specific mission of documenting American music. Like the earlier British collectors, they believed they were helping to preserve music that was unique to their country and that expressed its true values. Key among these collectors were a father and son team named John and Alan Lomax. Born in Goodman, Mississippi, John Avery Lomax was fascinated with local songs and legends that he heard from his neighbors, family, and friends. He also absorbed many ideas from popular novels and newspapers, which promoted several mythic American figures and ideas. The frontiersman was an established American stereotype, thanks to the hugely popular books by James Fenimore Cooper. Translated to the Southwest, a new hero, the cowboy, a lone hero driving cattle across a barren landscape fighting off hostile natives, was born. While promoted as true blue Americans, many real cowboys were Native Mexican, or mestizo, of mixed Spanish and Native heritage, known as vaqueros, who brought with them their own style of story songs. Like Anglo-American ballads, these songs immortalized the exploits of these hard-working men. When Lomax entered Harvard, he met folklorist George Lyman Kittredge, a noted collector of folk ballads, who encouraged his students to collect songs. Lomax published his first collection of what he called cowboy songs in 1910. A canny promoter, Lomax enlisted naturalist and politician Teddy Roosevelt to write the book's preface. Like other early collectors, Lomax only printed the lyrics to the songs, many of which he had collected either from local newspapers or from correspondents who sent him the words to songs they had heard. Although presented as authentic, many of these songs were in fact 19th-century compositions that greatly sentimentalized the cowboy lifestyle. Lomax's book became the source for many so-called cowboy recording stars from the 30s on, introducing songs that have become veritable chestnuts, such as Home on the Range. After working for a while in banking and as a dean at the University of Texas, Lomax returned to his first love, collecting traditional songs. He took to the road in 1933, bringing along one of the first portable recording machines. It recorded on discs and was powered by the battery of his car. His 18-year-old son, Alan, accompanied him. While the elder Lomax had many racial prejudices common to his generation, his son was an avowed champion of the people, sympathetic to the Communist Party and its progressive agenda. Alan Lomax would become director of the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song in the late 40s, as well as a prominent spokesperson for traditional music on the radio. He was among the first to recognize the value of early country music recordings when, working in the late 1940s as a consultant to the Decca record label, he produced two collections of 78s that reissued earlier country hits. The Lomaxes published several collections of traditional music, including 1934's American Ballads and Folk Songs, 1941's Our Singing Country, and 1947's Folk Song USA, featuring the song's melodies as well as lyrics. In the late 50s, Alan was among the first to take stereo equipment into the field, producing two large series of recordings of traditional country and blues music from the South. Undoubtedly influenced by his leftist politics, Alan viewed this music as an authentic expression of the people, as opposed to the pop music of his day, which he thought was produced solely for the profit of commercial interests. He considered the lyrics of many pop songs to be vapid and trite, while folk songs expressed real feelings and documented important events in the life of the country. Ironically, much of the music that Lomax championed had its source in the same commercial music industry as the pop songs he despised, although it was produced decades earlier, so many people failed to make this connection. While Lomax preferred singers like Aunt Molly Jackson, who sang of the struggles in the coal fields and the need for workers to unionize, he didn't ignore music that was purely for entertainment, including the ballads, songs, and dance tunes that he recorded throughout his long career. African-American traditions, work songs, religious music, and blues. No American musical story is complete without including the rich heritage of music that was brought to this continent through the terrible practice of slavery. Despite many attempts to suppress their music, these transplanted people had a huge impact on American culture. African singing styles, repertory, and approaches to rhythm and performance were all hugely influential beginning as early as the 18th century. And despite prejudice and racism, musicians on both sides of the color line shared ideas that led to the creation of truly American musical styles. Perhaps because the slaves were brought to this country to perform manual labor, particularly working in the vast cotton fields of the South, their first great contributions to American music were work songs. These songs had many functions, to coordinate the work of a group of people, such as in digging ditches or building a wall, to communicate across a distance, or to express deep emotions or comment on events of the day. Singers brought African characteristics to this new musical style, including flattening of certain notes, later known as blue notes, elongating and embellishing certain notes for extra emphasis, and stretching the beat to the point of near stasis. Slavery was supported by a concerted effort to erase African traditions and replace them with European ones. Nowhere was this stronger than in the practice of religion. Although many African religious traditions survived, sometimes carefully hidden from the eyes of their white masters, many others were subsumed into European Christianity. By the late 19th century, this led to the development of what became celebrated as African-American spirituals. Sung using European harmonies and expressing approved religious sentiments, spirituals were admired by both white and black listeners. For whites, they seemed to indicate that the black population had been successfully incorporated into American life. Men were happy with their lot as second-class citizens. For black listeners, particularly those who strived toward joining the middle class, the spirituals featured just enough elements of African vocal and rhythmic styles to be identifiably black, while clothed in an acceptable white form. This was no doubt aided by tours of vocal groups associated with the new black colleges that were formed during Reconstruction, most notably the Fisk University Singers from Nashville, who performed in the United States and abroad for white audiences. Perhaps the musical style most closely associated with African-American musicians that developed during the final third of the 19th century was the blues. Some believe that this song style combined elements of work songs, particularly those that employed free rhythms to express intense feelings, with the more regular forms introduced through the spirituals. So-called songsters were the main purveyors of this new musical style. These performers sang a range of different types of popular songs and usually performed within a small region, on city streets, in work camps, and outside of factories, or any other place people gathered outside of the church. They developed a repertory of songs that commented on current events, true love, and love gone wrong, as well as the hard lot faced by most African Americans. All of these topics would be central to country music as well. Eventually, these songs would be incorporated by more professional songwriters and performers into a more regular form, featuring a fixed harmonic progression and a 3 or 4 line stanza. This would become the commercial blues that exploded into popularity in the early 20s. The beginnings of commercial country music. Just as in other fields, commercial interests entered the entertainment world as new industries, including native music publishing and the opening up of performance spaces in big cities and smaller towns, grew rapidly. As transportation improved, it became possible for professional entertainers to make a living, often traveling with their own tents and other accoutrements, so they could stage shows in even the most remote locations. Beginning in the 1830s, a new musical entertainment swept the nation. This first great American popular music, which would become known as minstrelsy, mixed European and African musical traditions. Despite its roots in racist parody, it embodied the kind of musical interchange that would become central to the development of most American popular music styles, including country music. Its white originators freely admitted that they copied the music and performance styles of their black neighbors, and inadvertently opened their countrymen's ears to the lure of syncopated song and dance. The minstrels used a number of musical instruments, including both melody instruments, ranging from small accordions, known as melodeons, to fiddles, and rhythmic ones, often a pair of animal bones were clacked together to provide a rhythmic accompaniment. But the
sample complete. Ready to continue?